Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Tonight, Weldon Action uncovers the sinister world of Combat 18. Late last year, people all over England began getting death threats. Some claim to be from the Ku Klux Klan.
We have got your location and where you live, and we will be watching you, and we're going to take you out. It's as simple as that. You're nothing but a Jewish slag. You will be taken out by the Ku Klux Klan.
Just let her know that Combat 18 have got her eye on her. We're going to take her out.
In a picturesque corner of Norfolk, Alison Loughlin runs a guest house. It's a retreat for people wanting a break from city life. Last year, she donated a weekend here as a prize in a raffle for the anti-apartheid movement. This innocent gesture led to a frightening telephone encounter.
He said, have you ever had anyone from the anti-apartheid movement? And I said, yes, I have. I was happy to receive some people who'd won the raffle prize. I said, in what connection do you ask? And he said, oh, well, we've heard that you had those people, and we don't like that, and we're going to make... And I said, well, I'm not sure that you've really got the right impression about this. And he said, oh, yes, we've certainly got the impression about what you're doing, and we don't like it, and we're going to be making a very nasty impression on you. And I said, well, you know, can you just tell me who I'm talking to? And he said, it's a member of the British Ku Klux Klan.
Another victim was Cheshire holiday operator Martin Vasey. Like Alison Loughlin, his generosity had made him a target.
We received a call that came on our answer phone one Friday night. A person describing himself as from the British Ku Klux Klan. He said that it had come to his notice that we'd offered a prize to the anti-apartheid movement for a fun run that they were doing down in London. And he said as a result of that, he wasn't very happy about it and the offices would be attacked. We wondered whether it was a bit of a prank, a bit of a joke, but it was true that we had given this prize, and so the person obviously knew about that, and we took it seriously enough to contact the local police.
I felt distinctly vulnerable, really. I thought, well, is something going to happen immediately? How shall I know? Do I go on trusting people? Do I lift up the phone?
Martin Vasey and Alison Loughlin, and the many other victims of similar threats, had no way of knowing they'd been targeted by an extremist group called Combat 18. Nor did they know it was already engaged in physical attacks on people it saw as its enemies.
Combat 18 could be described as an organisation participating in political terrorism, viewed in the context of threats of violence and carrying out that violence.
Combat 18 is thought to have about 70 active members. It takes its name from the first and eighth letters of the alphabet, the initials of Adolf Hitler.
It believes in organising itself on a cell structure, not a mass political movement, and it believes there is a certain amount of security in following a cell structure, so that infiltration by the police or security organisations is limited to the persons involved in a particular cell.
Combat 18's hit lists appear in its members-only bulletin called Red Watch. Copies obtained by World in Action reveal that scores of people have been targeted. They also reveal why. Combat 18 is a fanatical neo-Nazi group whose intended victims are usually Jews or its political opponents. Several MPs are singled out for harassment.
These publications have been called hit lists. Is that fair?
I think that's a very fair description, because what other interpretation can one place on a list of names and addresses circulated to members? It must be for the purpose of at least harassment.
And at worst?
And at worst, severe physical attack.
March the 27th at a bookshop in East London. The quiet of a normal Saturday is about to be shattered.
They were wearing hoods with slits showing only their eyes. They had carved and painted wooden clubs.
Freedom Press, a small radical publisher's for over 100 years, had become the latest victim of Combat 18. The cell carrying out the attack worked with clinical efficiency.
But within a couple of minutes, and this happened very quickly, within 2 or 3 minutes, they smashed anything to do with typesetting. There's a computer typesetting machine, and another machine, which is a laser jet printer. They smashed that with their clubs, and then went straight off out. Definitely, this was with military precision. Yes, these people knew what they were doing.
Before they left, the raiding party left a calling card. Above a door, they sprayed C-18. Until now, little has been known about Combat 18. Its Red Watch hit list was seen only by its own members. The rare copies which leaked out gave only a post office box address in America. But that address is a clue to the shadowy figure behind Combat 18. Greensboro, North Carolina, in the United States. In November 1979, right-wing fanatics attack a demonstration against the Ku Klux Klan. They produce guns and they open fire. They kill 5 people. It became known as the Greensboro Massacre. Pulling the triggers were members of several Ku Klux Klan and Nazi groups. One of their leaders, though he was not present at the shootings, was a veteran Nazi called Harold Covington. The American address given on C-18's Red Watch hit lists is Covington's own P.O. Box in North Carolina. Dixie Press is his publishing company, also based in North Carolina. Red Watch describes how any information about potential targets is to be sent to the Dixie Press address, and
our brothers in America will then redirect any correspondence back to our safe address here in England.
And in Red Watch, Combat 18 thanks Big H in North Carolina for his help. Tried before an all-white Southern jury, all the Greensboro gunmen were acquitted. But interviewed even as his men stood trial, Covington had no regrets about what had happened.
I do not give a happy damn about their human rights or anything else. They got what they deserved.
You show no remorse toward the families or the victims?
One shouldn't show remorse for stamping on a rattlesnake.
And even then, Covington was talking about a new approach for his followers.
We've got a whole new plan, a whole new method of operating that we're going to initiate. It's a response to the fact that the government has tried to kill us here 4 times in the past 18 months. And it involves putting the party on a semi-underground status, but it also involves a whole new tactical direction for the movement.
Harold Covington no longer appears in his stormtrooper's uniform, but he's still an active Nazi. And today he's putting into action his plan to build an underground Nazi movement. In his own newsletter, Resistance, he describes how he's setting up a network of cells across the world. One of those cells is Combat 18. Covington is much more than just Combat 18's postman. Last year, after shaving off his characteristic beard, he was staying secretly in Britain. Here, he linked up with British Nazis to set up Combat 18. Travelling on an Irish passport, obtained when he married an Irish woman, he spent last summer in this house in East London. When his cover was blown, he abandoned the house and fled. He hasn't been seen in public since. He was in Britain at exactly the time that Combat 18's campaign of death threats began.
It's very significant that Covington is involved. He's not just another loony right-winger attracted by the fantasy of Nazi uniforms or Ku Klux Klan. He's a man with a long history of involvement in violent activity. What it gives them the experience of organizing on a clandestine basis. It gives them the experience of the use of violence and how to target your enemies, how to collect information on your enemies, which is what his organization was doing in America in the 70s. Covington is trying to build a clandestine neo-Nazi organization dedicated to violent activity as he did in America.
Earlier this year, one C-18 member broke ranks. We'll call him Simon. Alarmed at what he was getting into, he contacted World in Action. He told us what C-18 was set up to do and how it does it. To protect his identity, we've used an actor. But these are Simon's exact words.
Well, basically, we're talking about political terror. People on the far right have always said that too much time was spent talking about things and what was needed was action. When the opposition to the far right got organised, and there was a real call for it, and the people involved just decided to put something together and basically give the right-wing punters what they wanted, which is Red's heads being cracked.
And soon, heads were being cracked. World in Action has established that at least two serious gang attacks last year, where people were badly injured, were secretly planned and carried out by Combat 18. Tim Heppel was a senior member of the British National Party, Britain's biggest extreme right party, and worked at their headquarters. But the BNP didn't know he was an infiltrator, spying for their anti-fascist opponents. In February last year, he was recruited by C-18 to join an attack on peaceful anti-Nazi campaigners in East London.
Welcome to Voice of Albion, John Tyndall, Part 9. First you heard part of a documentary called World in Action, Combat 18 Programme. As mentioned in previous podcasts, white nationalists had no media like we do today, so things were very one-sided. Although World in Action was a far-left supporting documentary programme, it still has useful historical information. So much so, there was a new film released this year called The World in Action Years, narrated by the actor John Hurt. It's clear from the first 10 minutes of the World in Action C-18 programme that the purpose of the episode was to link the BNP to the violent acts of C-18. The BNP had gained a councillor in 1993, which was a first for a nationalist party in Britain, and it sent shockwaves throughout the establishment. This was achieved by the hard-working activists of the BNP under John Tyndall. 2 years after the victory, John Tyndall discussed Combat 18 in his journal Spearhead. The date of the article was September 1995. It was entitled The Destructive Role of Combat 18 and Its Allies. The article is very lengthy, so I'll start at the most relevant point. I'll post a link on the show page with the full article from Spearhead. There's a subheading, Why No Prosecutions? John Tyndall writes in Spearhead, 1995. I've mentioned one prosecution in which I was involved a long time ago. However, the law that applied then still applies now. Not so long ago, I was involved in another prosecution, this time under a section of the Public Order Act of 1986, concerned with race relations. Along with the editor of British Nationalist, John Morse, I was put in a dock for having written and published material likely to stir up race hatred. We were both given sentences of 1 year each, later reduced on appeal to 6 months. This was in 1986. Just a year ago, I was given a copy of a publication bearing the name of Combat 18. It was printed on glossy paper and must have cost money to produce. On reading some of the contents, I saw immediately that references to members of ethnic minority groups far exceeded in the extremity of their language anything that John Morse or I had ever written in our own publications. In one section, there was talk of sending blacks home in body bags. In this and other publications turned out by these jokers, there were constant incitements to people to commit acts of violence in pursuit of their political aims. And in another glossy product, again bearing the name of Combat 18, there were instructions on bomb making. If ever there was a case of there being reasonable apprehension, in quotes, that these people were organised and trained for the purpose enabling them to be employed for the use or display of physical force in promoting any political object, these items supplied all the evidence that should have been needed. So were the leaders of Combat 18 prosecuted? Well, there was a police raid on the homes of two of them a few months ago, and hundreds of these items were taken away as evidence. But in the final outcome, the decision was made not to prosecute. Why? This is a very big why, for it opens up some very interesting questions. The establishment jails Morse and Tyndall in 1986, and Tyndall and others some years earlier, in one case for racial hatred, in another for reasonable apprehension. Yet with far greater evidence in the hands of prosecution in both these regards, no action is taken against the leaders of Combat 18. Is there not a peculiar stink in this? So who is behind Combat 18? For myself, I can see no logical reason whatever for this failure to prosecute the C-18 people, other than that it suits the establishment to keep C-18 in existence. And why should it do so? other than to enable CA-18 to be used as a weapon for damaging and, if possible, destroying the British National Party. Does this mean that the chief operatives of CA-18 are conscious and willing agents of the state, deliberately working against the nationalist cause? Not necessarily. I myself am very little acquainted personally with the people of whom I am talking. For my knowledge of them, I rely on the intellectual content of their publication, which beggars a description, and the personal assessment of some of my friends and colleagues who know them a bit better than I do. From this information, the profile that forms is one of people of very meagre intelligence, albeit equipped with a certain destructively low cunning. It is difficult for me to believe that such people are capable of masterminding such a complex operation as the one in which I suspect they are engaged, namely an operation to sabotage the nationalist movement in general, and our party in particular. It seems much more likely that they are just small-time gang leaders, class warriors with huge chips on their shoulders, ambitious to build their own little backstreet empires, and resentful of others who seem to stand in their way. This alone could not account for all the activities in which they have been involved. Somewhere there has to be a directing brain, much superior to theirs, able to manipulate them to purposes which they would scarcely begin to understand. So who might this be? Enter the mysterious Mr. Covington. In our investigations into people with contacts with Combat 18, one name kept on cropping up again and again. This was an American called Harold Covington, who was found resided in Britain for a while some years ago and was closely involved with a number of people from whose ranks CA-18 emerged. It has been suggested that he was CA-18's founder. Mr. Covington's political ideas closely paralleled those being peddled by CA-18 today. It seems that at that time he was doing a lot of jetting around the world while pleading poverty to his supporters. It was a matter of interest to us that Mr. Covington was able to stay in the country for some while having no trouble with immigration authorities as an undesirable, a hospitality not extended to revisionist Fred Lochter, as many of our readers will recall. I happened to meet Mr. Covington when he called at my home back sometime around 1981. I certainly found him to be intelligent, though there was something about the man's personality that told me I should be on my guard. I did not think very much more about him until the CA-18 business forced us to take a further look at him. I promptly did some writing and telephoning to my numerous friends and contacts in the United States to see what they could tell me about Mr. Covington. The picture that emerged only deepened my suspicions concerning his liaison with people over here. Covington, I learned, had built for himself a notorious reputation throughout the racial movement in America as a catalyst of internal conflict, distrust and division. He made a speciality out of condemning some of the leading activators of the American right, either just by disparaging their efforts as being of no value, or by going yet further and blackening their characters with highly personalised smears. He spent a great deal of time sending circulars to people all around the world, the contents of which were occupied with attacks made more on fellow racial nationalists than on our common political enemies. This latter I could confirm because two of those circulars had been posted to me. One letter of the movement in the US who I know personally and whose judgment I greatly respect told me he thought it very likely that Covington had for some years been working for the FBI, though I have no way of proving or disproving this. What is known is that Combat 18 had for a while used an American contact address for some of its literature so as to get around Britain's draconian race laws. This address, when traced, turned out to be one supplied by Harold Covington. If my American contacts theory about Covington's connections are correct, it would mean that large numbers of people in Britain who have written off to his mailing address in response to CA-18 literature would have had their names and addresses passed on straight away to the FBI, who would in turn have supplied them to the political police in this country, whether MI5, Special Branch, or both. I'll leave the article there. As I said, I'll post it because it's quite long. Now, chapter 11 of John Tyndall's 11th Hour. Chapter 11, Freedom, the Illusion and the Reality. JT begins. From the first moment that individuals discovered that they were not alone on this planet, they have found the need to combine together in communities for common survival, with the good of the individual and that of the community being seen as complementary to one another. The safety and security of the individual have depended at all times on the efficiency of the community's services of law enforcement and, in times of outside threat, on the effectiveness of the community's military defences. The prosperity of the individual has depended on the community's aggregate resources of wealth and its organisation of the forces of production. The very freedom of the individual has depended on the community's power to prevent antisocial elements endangering that freedom. These truths are so obvious and elementary that a small child should be able to understand them. Yet everything that liberalism has to say about the relationship between individual and community is an implicit rejection of them. Liberals, JT goes on, depreciate the idea of strong state and government on the grounds that these will violate the rights of the individual and oppress him. Yet, JT asks, what are a strong state and government other than simply expressions of an effective communal organisation and will? Liberals fail to recognise that where state and government are weak, it is not the individual who is thereby strengthened. What happens is that a vacuum of power is created into which will step other forces which, unrestrained, are much more liable to violate the rights and therein the interests of the individual than any state power. JT uses the present workings of local government in Britain as an example. The powers extended to town halls and the right of local citizens to choose who will run these town halls on their behalf are popularly regarded as an ideal expression of liberal democracy at work, contrasted as this is with the authoritarian administration of a centralised state. Yet what has this done for the local citizen today? It has simply placed him, in many areas, in a position of subjection to petty Soviet tyrannies, run by miniature Stalins, ready to lavish taxpayers' money on all manner of projects in no way desired or approved by local townspeople. Lack of strong central government authority has been the factor that has made for these tyrannies. JT continues, liberalism claims to set great store on economic freedom as a prerequisite of other freedoms, but when we delve into the actual working of economic freedom as it turns out in nations governed by liberal theory, we find that it is the freedom not of the ordinary wage earner or even the ordinary small businessman, but that of the huge multinational industrial and commercial empires. Specifically, the freedom is consummate with economic power, and of this the ordinary citizen has little. That ordinary citizen can, however, greatly suffer from the workings of such power by being deprived of his livelihood through international movements of capital that weak governments do not possess the will to stop. From these examples, JT states, it will be seen that the claim of liberal democracy to bestow upon man the highest freedom that he can attain is pure fraud. When the liberal shouts, as he continually does, about freedom, in quotes, he really has in mind freedoms entirely different from those that are of interest to the average citizen. But of course, the average citizen's freedoms and rights have never figured highly among liberal priorities. Aside from the economic freedom to which I have referred, there is the freedom from fear. Fear from harm to person, family and property, fear of the late night attack in the dark street, fear of every kind of lawlessness that might menace the life of the respectable citizen. Is this fear greater or less in a society governed by liberal doctrines? JT suggests that it is much more greater, and for the reason of the wholly inadequate protection given in such a society to the law-abiding against the criminal. The average man wants the freedom to do a decently paid job and to be able to change it if he wishes. He wants the freedom that comes of owning his own home within reasonable time of his first acquiring it. He wants the freedom to send his children to a decent school of his choice. He wants the freedom for himself and his family to be able to walk the streets and parks of his neighbourhood at any hour of the day or night in peace and safety. He wants the freedom to be able to spend his leisure time as he would wish, and facilities to do so that are within his means. He wants the freedom to choose his friends, and if he is in business, to decide with whom he will trade and whom he will hire or fire. Last but not least, JT concludes, he wants freedom from financial debt. Only a small minority seeks the freedom to take part or have a say in politics, and this is particularly so with the British, who are not by nature a highly political people. The average Briton, when the subject of politics comes up, declares that he simply is not interested and tries, as soon as possible, to switch the conversation to football, television, or the merits of the various holiday resorts or local restaurants. Political freedom to him is almost valueless as he does not have the slightest disposition to use it, and, when he does, he seldom knows how. He just wants to live his own life in peace and concern himself with his own family, his job, and his club. That is, football club. This truth, JT contends, will come uncomfortably to the liberal, who has, in his mind's eye, a picture of the mass of people passionately concerned with public issues and using their collective will and wisdom to decide the nation's destiny. But anyone with a grain of understanding, JT asserts, of the real workings of politics in Britain knows this liberal idea to be sheer fantasy. The fact that most elections in Britain now, at the local level, have a 20% turnout shows this is even more so the case. Real freedom of the kind valued by our ancestors comes from a liberation of the mind and spirit. The truly free man is the one who is master of his own instinct for what is right and wrong, who is own judge of what is beautiful and ugly, in literature, in art, in music, and all else. Freedom is the independent faculty for formulating values, loves, and loyalties. A person who has these attributes does not then become less free by submitting himself to certain restraints and disciplines devised for the maintenance of a strong and cohesive community, nor by acknowledging the necessity in every community for leadership and by respecting and following leadership when it manifests itself. Britain today, JT writes, is afflicted with an all too large segment of the population consisting of parasitic and useless slobs who continue nothing whatsoever, contribute nothing whatsoever to society, but who are the first to expect that society will look after them, help them when they are in trouble, grant them every kind of right and afford them every kind of protection. Indeed, it seems sometimes that the whole of our society's amenities, welfare, compassion and help are directed towards making life as easy as possible for this sediment of the populace, at the expense of useful and responsible citizens. This is, of course, a natural consequence of liberal values in operation. First, liberalism, by its lack of firm leadership and direction, particularly in people's early and formative years, breeds legions of these misfits. Then, by the softness of the social order under which we live, it keeps them in comfort and security for the rest of their lives. The British public is well used to picking up its daily papers and reading of drunken mobs of tourists disgracing their country's name by their oafish behaviour abroad. But in fact, these specimens are only the natural product of a society which fails from the very beginning to instil into many of its young people the virtues of national pride, discipline, tidiness, temperate habits, and responsible civil conduct. JT states that the first priority in creating a population fit for a respectable place in the world must be with the young. He lists patriotism and national pride as the first civic duty to be taught. History, with an emphasis on Britain's achievements, but not glossing over weaknesses. The importance of Britain as a whole, while not excluding a pride of identity on the part of its component land and peoples. That's to say, to be proud to be British, but still English, Welsh, Scottish, Irish. Education should emphasise the all-important link between the people of the British Isles and the ethnic kinfolk overseas. Educating young people to understand race does not mean the promotion of hatred for other races. And JT believes that the latter tendency should be firmly excluded from any school teaching. At the same time, while they should be encouraged to recognise the special qualities and attributes of the respective races of the world, they should not be deceived that those qualities and attributes are the same. It must be firmly inculcated into the young that we British belong to the European family of races and cultures, and that for them, when they come of age, marriage and the procreation of children outside the family is harmful and wrong to all races concerned. Next in importance among the young, indeed of equal importance, is to build the foundations of a healthy and fitter British race, and this aim must be linked with that of establishing a firm polarity between the sexes, with young males being imbued with the qualities of manhood and young girls with those of womanhood. One of the most revolting phenomena of our present liberal society is the growth of effeminate tendencies in young males, tendencies that can be seen in weak and vapid features, unisex voices, lack of upright bearing, and a general interest in pursuits alien to the instincts of masculinity. JT states, blame for this rests at least partially with shortcomings in education, but much of it can be attributed to the baneful influence of the mass media, which seems dedicated to the cult of the new man, the wimp whose feet seem planted neither firmly on the ground of one sex nor another. It is perhaps not coincidental that the leading personalities of present-day politics reflect this trend, and one of the more depressing symptoms is that an increasingly number of young women of our race, with a shortage of real men to whom to attach themselves, seek substitutes among other races. On physical education, JT writes, proper physical education is a part, though by no means the only part, of the necessary remedy for this problem. Diet and environmental factors also come into play, and here we need to take much more seriously recent research which indicates the effect of certain chemicals on the male sperm count, which is probably not unconnected with the emergence of feminine traits in modern man. Physical education in most schools in Britain today is appallingly inadequate, and this can be seen in the depressingly large numbers of people in this country of very poor physique, as well as the horror rate of sickness. Quick point on that. The government has been selling off school sports fields in recent years. At a local councillor's level, the local councillors are allowing endless cheap fast food outlets to open, which are usually owned by non-whites. So John Tyndall had foresight in 1998, and any Brits will tell you it's definitely got a lot worse in that respect. Continue. JT proposes regular, vigorous body exercise for the school curriculum, with PE periods increased in both number and toughness, especially for boys. Weight training and at least one full contact sport such as rugby, boxing, wrestling or one of the martial arts are recommended. The nation should be prepared to undertake a vast increase in expenditure to provide adequate school and after school facilities for all the young to use in a drive for fitness and strength. On diet, JT comments, much of the food that many British people eat is pure junk. Not only should there be an ongoing national campaign of education in these matters, but there should also be a firm policy of eliminating these junk foods from our shops and substituting natural and wholesome products. JT states that liberals would refer to such methods as food fascism and says it would be a waste of time engaging in argument with them on this subject. The rise of feminism, JT links to the decline of the white race. The real man brings out the best in woman. Where manhood is in short supply, woman begins to try to ape man and become a substitute for him. JT also favours a cadet force where every schoolboy goes through rudimentary military training, as well as regular adventure courses which expose him to rough living and, within certain limits, physical danger. He also believes national service should return in Britain, which was done away with in 1960. Class war, JT states, should have no place in a truly national community, but rather than merely utter that sentiment as a platitude, we must take positive action to organise national affairs so as to remove the causes of this particularly pernicious form of conflict. Part of this task lies in education, but part also in putting an end to the abuses that generate attitudes to class antagonism. Here I'll play a short clip of John Tyndall speaking on this subject. The title of the clip is White Socialism. It looks to be a speech at a BNP meeting in the early 90s.
There are certain people around who call themselves nationalists and are always whining on about the working class against the middle class, and the BNP with its middle class leadership, which is a lie from us for the start, because our leadership comes from all sections of society. We don't want class warriors in this party, no more than we want class warfare in the Britain of the future. We want every British person, whether they work by hand or by brain, whether by the sweat of their brow or whether by cerebral sweat, we want all of them to join hands, and everybody who is doing a useful job for Britain will be part of our national community. And let's have an end.
JT continues. What is important is that class divisions should never be allowed to reflect separate and ultimately antagonistic group interests, as has happened in this country, resulting in the two leading political parties for many decades, representing the polarity of classes, in which each one's commitment to what is perceived as the interest of its own social group led it ipso facto into the assumption that this interest must be furthered at the expense of other social groups. By this attitude, a kind of class patriotism has pervaded British life, and in the course of doing so, has largely superseded national patriotism. And of course, this state of affairs is tailor-made for those who would wish to divide the British people in order to conquer them. One class is played off against the other by the presentation of politics as being a class struggle, while the real enemy of all classes tightens his grip. On social services, JT writes, "Our social service ethic should be based on the time-honoured dictum that you do not help the weak by discouraging or undermining the strong. The first ideal of sound social welfare should be a strong population, and we should recognise the truth that such a national asset and the resources it creates must be the main basis on which we are able to take care of the genuinely weak and needy. One of the most vital needs in the pursuit of a strong and healthy population is to reverse the alarming decline in the national birth rate." JT observes that it is noteworthy that no one of the established political parties of Westminster has shown any real concern over this, let alone done anything about it. Instead, we have complacently sat back and watched with equanimity a process which in effect amounts to a slow national death. It should not require a professional mathematician to work out that a drastically declining birth rate means inevitably that the average age of the community is gradually going to increase, and that in consequence, year by year, we're going to have a diminishing portion of young, able-bodied and active, supporting a growing portion of elderly and in large part inactive. If we are concerned, as many are, about the present strain on the resources of the health and social services, we should see that this strain is only going to increase as long as this tendency of national infertility remains. That such a prospect should not alarm our present leaders is a token of their unconcern for the nation's future. Needless to say, it is also significant that nations and races which restrict their births in the world where other nations and races are fast increasing theirs will in time suffer a relative decline in strength, which could be disastrous. One of the factors that most profoundly affected the international balance of power between the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the start of the First World War was that while France sustained a very modest birth rate for much of that period, those of the Anglo-Saxon and German races were comparatively high. Today, the British have become sterile, while the coloured world is increasing at an alarming rate. This would be bad enough in itself, were it not for the fact that it is made 10 times worse by the liberals and bleeding hearts amongst us, who, with every 10 million that is added to the coloured world's population, intensify their demands on us Britons and other whites to hand over our hard-earned wealth to feed and clothe the extra millions. JT contends that it is preferable that the population size of Britain should become stabilised at approximately its present level. A vigorous birth rate at home should be balanced by a high rate of emigration to other parts of the white Commonwealth, where there are abundant open spaces waiting to be filled up, and which should far preferably be filled up by Anglo-Saxons and Celts than by other races. One important step towards countering the catastrophic fall in the British birth rate should be the repeal of the law permitting abortion, with at the time of writing has prevented the birth of some 4 million British children, who for the most part would have been valuable additions to our population. JT hastens to add, however, that that is far from being the only reason that he advocates such a step. He believes that abortion is a crime from every point of view, except in those cases where, on the advice of doctors, it is necessary to protect the mother's life or prevent the birth of children with terrible mental and physical deficiencies. Apart from anything else, JT adds, abortion on demand encourages a total, irresponsible attitude towards sexual relations, which impart of the general pattern of promiscuity, permissiveness and plummeting moral standards, for which we have to thank the liberals who have run riot in our society over the past few decades. Legislation against abortion is just one item in a series that will be needed to reverse the trend of moral anarchy that has rotted the fibre of Britain in recent times. Another is a repeal of the law permitting acts of homosexuality. This is just one more piece of rulemaking that our political masters have sprung upon us without the slightest indication that it ever had the endorsement of the people. It has proved a wholly regressive step which has now rebounded against its promoters with the recent spread of the AIDS disease. I'll just add an interesting thing about AIDS. I came across it when I was researching advanced immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, and approximately 12% of Europeans apparently are completely immune to AIDS, and in Scandinavia the figure is 15%. You could look that up. JT continues, the unleashing of homosexual freedom has also given rise to the emergence of a gay mafia of perverts that has eaten its way into the fabric of our cultural and intellectual life, impregnating that life with its values and philosophy. When the homosexual community shouts for gay rights, what it really means and wants is gay power. Like certain other minorities, the Pufters call for emancipation as a euphemism for an aggressive imperialism all of their own, in which they work to promote their brethren and expand their lifestyle everywhere. Quite apart from the moral, and indeed now also the medical, considerations involved in the fight against homosexuality, that fight must be seen as a token of our pursuit of the ideals of true manhood and womanhood, which we must recover if our nation is to recover. The literary and artistic products of the homosexual mind can only flourish in a society where heterosexual values have been gravely weakened, and that very simply is a society that has become degenerate. Legislation alone would not drive this perversion into the catacombs where it belongs. It must be accompanied by a total change in national outlook, aiming at a national cultural, moral and spiritual renaissance. Again, to reduce matters to the simplest terms, the fight is against decadence. The natural pressures upon us to lead healthy and ordered lives, conducted in accordance with moral rules, have mostly disappeared. We now have an environment which brings with it a totally different danger. The danger that, cosseted by it day and night, we will grow soft in body, mind and will. How is this terrifying danger to be averted? JT states, I can see no means of averting it except by our preparedness to welcome what Spengler called the resurgence of authority. We may rationalise until kingdom come in favour of the freedom for every vile and obscene tendency in our cultural life. Such rationalising will not avail us when we have been driven out of existence or into servitude by stronger, more disciplined cultures, which, so long as we continue on our present ways, will be destined by the unalterable laws of nature to supersede us and consign us to the dustbin of perished civilizations. That's the end of chapter 11. Next Sunday we'll have chapter 12, The Role of the Media. I'll play it now with a recording from a National Front meeting held in South London in April 2013. There's three speakers, Tess Cornane, London organiser, Tony Martin from Croydon, and Richard Edmonds. I met Tony at a BNP conference briefly in 2011. Bear in mind, it's not easy to do public speaking. One thing is true though, it is 10 times easier second time round. I'd urge any white nationalist to try it, even if only at a barbecue or similar social event where other white nationalists are around. Also, there's some background noise on the clip. This is from the other room in the pub. So it's a proper pub meeting where you often have to speak with noise from the other room, which is not connected to the meeting, which you've hired the one room. So I'll play with that. Merry Christmas, Happy Yule, thanks for listening, take care, 14 words.
Once again, it's a pleasure to be in the company of fellow nationalists. true, real British people who are here because of our blood and ancestry, not because we came to this country on the back of a lorry and were handed a piece of paper making us British at some ceremony where traitors vie with each other in making alien invaders welcome and inviting those invaders to become something they never can be, and encouraging them to take up permanent residence here and eventually, by sheer weight of numbers, outnumber and dispossess us. Cameron, for example, promised us a referendum on Europe, which must have been largely instrumental in getting him elected, only to renege once in office. Now he promises the same thing if returned to office in 2015. He is going to somehow limit immigration into this country. He only wants tens of thousands instead of hundreds of thousands, even tens of thousands, my friends, from anywhere on earth who arrive here have to be housed, employed, their children educated, and have full access to medical care. And if they are not employed, they receive benefits that are paid from borrowed money. As patriotic nationalists, we are under attack from many quarters, the latest assault coming from the rise in popularity of UKIP. The mesmerised electorate really think and imagine that the British people can be rescued from the nightmare scenario in which they find themselves by UKIP, whose only purpose is to deflect votes from real patriots. Time and time again, opportunities presented themselves to put our own people in Parliament. And time again, the electorate have lacked the courage to put a cross on the ballot paper. Time and time again, the British people fall for the trick of being promised something that will make life better, only to be betrayed once more. Another attack that we are subject to is our own people who have a vested interest in towing the traitorous line. Those British people who go along to get along and have carved out their own comfort zone. Police, for example, who would willingly charge a young mother surrounded by aliens on a tram who lost her son.
Shame.
She would face the full lash of the law, be thrown into prison and dragged into court. And yet a foreign criminal driving without a licence, MOT, insurance, who runs over a 12-year-old child and leaves her with fatal injuries and terrified under a car, is allowed to stay in this country because a judge rules that this criminal is entitled to a family life. The dead child's family have been denied the same right and have been sentenced to a lifetime of grief, compounded by the betrayal of the British justice. That judge is complicit in the manslaughter of that innocent child. Another score to be settled when we get into power. People like the aforementioned police and judges, like the one described, are only concerned with their salaries and their pensions, but they are harbouring the delusion that people like us are a spent force who can be crushed by lies and character assassination, choosing to ignore the fact that evil treachery only strengthens our resolve. On LBC Radio a few days ago, some idiot presenter, well, we all know what they like, don't we? One in particular I can mention, O'Brien. What a smart mouth that is. But anyway, these presenters informed us that without mass immigration, it would cost every British man and woman about £2,000 each. How on earth he arrived at this conclusion, I simply do not know. However, what I am very aware of is the fact that before we had mass immigration, or rather mass invasion, we managed quite well to survive in this country without the benefits bestowed upon us by muggers, drug dealers, gun runners, rioters and looters.
Exactly.
AIDS carriers.
Absolutely. And AIDS carriers.
Measles carriers as well.
Exactly. All we had was a civilised, Christian, law-abiding society where the punishment fitted the crime. On the same radio station, LBC, it was reported that two young men on a train, travelling, I believe, between Chiswick and Hammersmith, were approached by some subhuman thugs who demanded that these two decent fellas bought drugs. Because they refused, they were beaten up, and their radio and their mobiles were stolen. The programme presenter spoke as if he couldn't believe that such an attack could take place and certainly did not attach any blame to himself or other left-wing journalists who had nurtured and encouraged conditions such as these by their constant war of words against true patriots who they're fond of referring to as pond life or knuckle-scraping scum. Let us hope and pray that the time will soon come when people like these choke on their words. The NF is a very important part of our history. Every member here, anywhere, should be proud to be part of history in the making. We stand firm, unbending, determined, unrelenting and resolute in what we are doing, unlike the BNP, whose policies have been diluted. We will not accept Tom, Dick or Leroy Roy in our party. Our organisation is exclusive to racial nationalists. There is no place for liberals or fence-sitters. We are constant, steadfast, always have been, we always will be, until we win this war that has been raged against our race and nation. Thank you.
Hello everyone, thanks for having me at this. Thanks for coming everybody. First of all, I'd like to say about a couple of things that we've been up to in South London. The South London branch of the National Front has been going out leafleting in Worcester Park with our new Voting for Mosques leaflet, warning people that by voting for Lib, Lab and Con, they are in fact voting for a number of policies that are detrimental to the British way of life and to the British people. While we have been busy trying to help and awaken our people, the Conservative Party has been doing exactly the opposite. Gavin Barwell, the MP for Croydon Central, has written an article for the Conservative Home website entitled Seven Ways of Engaging Ethnic Minority Voters. In the article, which contains the usual pandering to these ethnic minorities, like getting the Prime Minister to do a speech about the so-called huge contribution that people from ethnic minorities allegedly make to our economy, and also making sure the Conservative Party looks like the communities they aspire to represent. They aspire to represent these foreign communities, and not us. Mr. Barwell then goes on to state that the Conservatives need to address the issues of growing faith communities, having difficulty in getting planning permission to convert a former pub or office into a place of worship. We all know who these grand faith communities are and what they want to turn our British pubs into. He also wants to target voters, he also wants to target voters from particular communities to feed them propaganda, like their MP speaking out against stop and search in Parliament, and when the government increases the money wasted in foreign aid to these countries, then to communicate this to the relevant voters. He wants to basically spend our money on these foreign countries and then go to the people from those countries and get them to vote for the Conservative Party. That is what the Conservative Party of Great Britain has now come to stand for. This guy is a Tory. People voted for him in 2010 to keep Labour out, and this is what they're doing. Another politician visited Croydon recently, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner. He's been touring our once great capital, trying to justify the government cuts to policing. He claimed falsely that all government budgets were being cut, when in fact foreign aid is being increased.
Yeah.
We can't afford to keep our police stations open, but we can afford to give money to countries around the world, many of which have trebled their population over the past 40 or so years. We are giving beyond our means. At the Hogan Howe meeting, I had the unexpected opportunity to ask the Met Police's most senior politician a question. This is the question asked: why are racially motivated crimes against white people not taken as seriously as those committed against other ethnic minorities?
Good question.
I know the Commissioner will try to deny this, so I have a couple of disgraceful examples. At this point, my microphone died, and I was explained to by the chair of the meeting that they didn't need examples. But there was only around 70 people at the meeting, so I managed to raise my voice and went on without a microphone.
Good man.
I said, firstly, the night stalker, Delroy Grant, was found guilty of a number of burglaries and rapes carried out on elderly men and women, all of whom were white, yet none of his crimes were treated as racially motivated. Secondly, the cases of a number of women arrested for allegedly racially motivated public order offences on public transport. Jacqueline Woodhouse, a white lady, was sentenced to 21 weeks imprisonment over an incident on the Central Line. Emma West, another white lady, is awaiting trial over an alleged incident on a Croydon tram and has already served a couple of weeks on remand. And Vandell Brooks, a black lady, was sentenced to 1 week imprisonment and a £200 fine for an incident on a London bus, a secret trial that the Met Police would not disclose the date of. Brooks had already failed to appear at a previous court hearing, so that included the failure to appear in that 1 week and the £200 fine. The police, Crown Persecution Service and the press all came down a lot harder on the white women than the black women. How do you justify this? Hogan Howe refused to fully answer the question on the grounds that some of the cases are ongoing. In fact, Emma West's case was the only case I've mentioned that is still ongoing, or was at the time. He did say that some cases need extra attention due to people being unable to speak English or having mental health issues. He then repeated the lie that everyone is treated equally regardless of race, which obviously we all know that's a lie. I won't speak too much about Emma West. I know Richard's speaking about it, but there is a card going around for people to make a comment and sign. That's about all I've got for now, so thanks very much.
Friends, Romans and countrymen, as Mark Antony said in his great speech over Julius Caesar, you may remember that Mark Antony was involved in a rather serious situation. There'd just been a serious murder. Julius Caesar had just been murdered. There was all sorts of strife in Rome. Rome was about to collapse into a civil war. terrible bloody civil war, and Mark Antony, who was certainly a great speaker, went before a very, very excited crowd in the city of Rome, a crowd that was completely on the side of the murderers of Julius Caesar, and everybody knew that Mark Antony was number two to Julius Caesar, and it took a nerve to face tens of thousands of angry Romans all waving their fists and swords around, and Mark Antony was a clever bloke and a brave man. He went before them all and he said, "Friends." Well, that's always a friendly thing to say, isn't it? "Romans," to remind them that they were all Romans, countrymen. And then he said, so clever, "Lend me your ears. I don't want your ears forever, no, want nothing else, just lend me your ears." And Mark Antony, if he'd made a slight psychological error, them 10,000 Romans would have torn him from limb from limb, because he was number two to Julius Caesar. And he started off, "I haven't come here to praise Julius Caesar." If he said one word in favour of Julius Caesar, who'd just been stabbed to death 10 minutes before in the Senate. But Mark Antony carried the crowd with him. So, in my very, very humble way, I will imitate what Mark Antony said 2,000 years ago. "Friends, Londoners, countrymen, lend me your ears." I'll introduce myself. I'm Richard Edmonds. I've been in this business quite a long time, and this is now the South London branch of the National Front. We've been busy in South London, and one of the things we did just before Christmas, polling day, Thursday the 29th of November 2012, I stood as a National Front candidate in Croydon North. Well, I'll describe Croydon North. Croydon North, with some exceptions, there are British people there. There are brave British people there, but when you come out to the main station, West Croydon Station, you could think that he was in Kabul, Afghanistan. Now, we thought, we knew the election came up, Tony and I and Tess and others, we talked about it, should we put a candidate up? Because the fact is, there are not many white people in Croydon North. When I first joined the National Front 40 years ago, do I need to repeat that? 40 years ago, and I've enjoyed every minute I've been in it, I've enjoyed every minute in nationalism. I'd recommend to anybody. I have gone from one party to another again, but one has to be broad-minded, I think. I think one has to be broad-minded. So, Croydon North. When I first joined the National Front, I went down to Pawson's Road, which is where that little shop was, and I knocked on the door, and they took me in, and I joined that party. In those days, Pawson's Road, Croydon North, was a white, British, working-class, lower-middle-class area of patriotic people. Now, Croydon North has been utterly destroyed. You come out of West Croydon Station, you could be in Kabul, Afghanistan. Cut a long story short, there are white people there, and we put out thousands of these leaflets, our team, thousands of leaflets. We survived to tell the tale. We went to the count. We was bold as brass at the count. There must have been 200 people in that count, Lib Lab Con and all the other parties, of the Black Power Party was there, represented by some fellow from North London. They were all there. No one said a dicky bird, as the Cockney is saying. No one said a word about us. We were large as life, looking at our votes. Anyway, the reason I stood in Croydon North is because I happened to live in the neighbouring town, Sutton. During those riots of 2 years ago, I was listening to my little radio, because I've never owned a television set. I don't care for television. So I was listening to my little radio set, and they said, "Croydon's burning." Croydon's burning. Anyway, cut along for a short. I came out of my house, walked just around the corner, and because Sutton's on the hill and Croydon's in the valley, it's about 2 miles away, I looked down and you could see, this was about 10:30 at night in August, you could see Croydon burning, you could see it all red, you could see the police helicopters above it all. And the people were coming out of their houses, and no one said a word. They'd obviously seen it on the television sets, and they had to look themselves with their own eyes. And this street, which sort of aims itself at Croydon, it's a straight line down to Croydon, down the bottom there, about 2 miles away. No one said a word, and I walked the length of the street, down the street, then up the street again, just looking at their faces, like men and women, husbands and wives, gawked at all this. And I'll tell you, I was the only person in that street who was not surprised. I've always known this was going to come, that's why I joined nationalism in the first place, which is why I, you know, thank you for coming, that you too, like me, are concerned about this country. And you too, like me, know that we can solve these problems. If we British people keep our nerve, we can solve all these problems. And I know that you know that, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You've given up an evening, freezing cold day, because we know that if we British people keep our nerve, we can solve these problems. And I stood in Croydon North as an act of defiance against the traitorous parties. Never miss an opportunity. Don't say the Labour Party, the Tory Party, the Liberal Party. Always say the anti-British Labour Party, the anti-British Conservative Party, the anti-British Liberal Party. Always get that anti-British in. And I stood as an act of defiance against the wicked people who have turned a decent working class, lower middle class area, as Croydon was, into a very, very dangerous area. Very, very dangerous. Those riots were very dangerous. God help anybody who's ever caught up in a bloody riot. All them blocks of, all them shops going up in flames, the whole lot. So we stood and we flew the flag in Croydon North. We flew the flag on behalf of the British people. So that's one of our activities that we've been involved in. We're campaigning all the time. We will shortly maybe switch over to Essex, where I think we've got candidates who might go and help you over there. But in the meantime, keeping in South London, as Tony referred, recently we've been doing some work in Worcester Park. Now, Worcester Park is in the London borough of Sutton. It is a very pleasant part of the world. You go to Worcester Park High Street, walk up and down, and you'd think, yes, it's pleasant. You'd think you're still in Britain. However, this outer London suburb, Worcester Park, where in the past they voted Tory, but nowadays they've got a Liberal council, so they sort of switch back between Tory and Liberal. This pleasant part of the world, Worcester Park, outer South London, some months ago, the good folk of that area woke up one morning to find that the Muslims had bought a building, an office building, right just off the high street, and that these Muslims intended turning this mosque, this building that they had purchased, they intended turning it into a mosque. And the Muslims went about putting in application to the council to change the use of the building from an office block into an Islamic centre and a mosque. Everybody in Worcester Park was immediately up in arms. That's how we learnt about it. It was in the local papers, it was on the local websites, and it was clear that we don't need to spell it out because our reaction is we understand 100%. The reaction of the townsfolk was they didn't want a mosque in Worcester Park because they knew that the mosque would attract large numbers of Muslims and that the Worcester Park would rapidly become, in the course of time, would become a, as in inner London, it would no longer be British. The Britishness of Worcester Park was in the balance. The fear was, the justified fear of the local people was that this new development, the mosque, would attract million or large numbers of Muslims and others, and that instead of having Worcester Park being part of Britain, you'd have Worcester Park threatened with being Kabul, Afghanistan. Which is, if you go to West Croydon, go to West Croydon station, walk down the London Road, you haven't got to go as far as a huge mosque at Thornton Heath. And you think, you would never think that you was in Britain, you would think that you was in Kabul, Afghanistan. And that is what galvanised the townsfolk of Worcester Park. They were up in arms. When it came to the public meeting to discuss the planning application, just before Christmas, the whole town was, what shall I say, seething, up in arms, certainly very, very agitated. And the authorities knew that that public meeting to discuss the application by the councillors on the planning committee was going to be a very hot evening. The council hired the largest hall that they could find in the area, a school hall. A group of us went along there, Tony and me and several others went along to it, and that meeting was packed. Not only packed, but packed to the ceiling, since there was a sort of upper level and there were people sitting and standing up there. There was at least 250 people in that hall. And at the top table were the councillors who had to make the decision, and it was clear to everybody in that hall, clear to the councillors who had to make the decision, and clear to every one of the people in that hall that the councillors were expected to do a thumbs down to the mosque application. And that's what happened. At the end of the evening, the councillors made their decision. This councillor, this councillor, this councillor, this councillor. Each and every councillor said, we are against the application, we are against the application of the mosque. To huge cheers from the crowded room. Now, we're in politics, and here comes the politics. And I say we're in politics because I've known a lot of you in this room years, some of you I've known decades. We have watched the problems, as Tess has said, get worse and worse and worse. The dangers for Britain, the dangers for our Britain, get ever worse. And the reason is, I was looking at 250 angry British people telling these councillors, we don't want this mosque. And I was thinking about it afterwards, because I play all this sort of stuff back in my mind. Playing it back, I thought, yes, very, very good. A sight for sore eyes. But, the but is, the vast majority of that people in that hall voted Tory, Liberal, and no doubt a minority Labour. The problem of the British people is, they don't want immigration, they don't want mass immigration, they don't want their towns turned into Kabul, Afghanistan, and yet they vote for the very parties that are burdening us with all these problems. So, a group of us, we put our heads together, and we produced a leaflet. By the way, if you want any of these leaflets, the samples at the top here, samples, samples, samples. We put our heads together to try, once again, to educate the British people. And I'll say, we nationalists, and I use the term we nationalists in a broad brush approach, and I was a member of the British National Party until about 18 months ago, never allow yourself to get defeated in your own minds. We know that we're going to win, and I'll now dot two eyes. Not just one eye, I'm going to dot two eyes, and I don't mean these peepers up here either. Dot eye. Back in 2009, a party which a lot of us were then in, which I was certainly in, at the Euros, almost a million people voted nationalist, voted BNP, that's the candidate at the time, yes. That was the party. A million people, never forget that, a million people went out and put those crosses. And then, just 12 months later, that same party, at the general election of 2010, when the general election coincided with the local government elections, that party put up 350 parliamentary candidates and plus 700 local government candidates. That party, a nationalist party in Britain, put up 1,000 candidates in one day. Now that is moving to the big time. You're moving to the big time. We, British nationalists, organised all that. We were interrupted, and there's been problems and difficulties. And I will say this of the problems and difficulties. They're nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'll tell you this, there's going to be, I'll put it in the future, right? I'll make a prediction with my vast experience in this game. There'll be difficulties and hiccups and problems in nationalism. Why? Because Britain itself is falling to bits, right? Britain is falling to bits. So if Britain is falling to bits, those difficulties are going to slop over into our movement at times. You have to be philosophical, you have to be adult, it's just how it is. But never forget our potential. A million votes, 2009, and a party that could put up 1,000 candidates. So, all we have, the main thing is that we keep our nerve. And I tell you, I don't know whether this is any consolation to you, but it is a consolation to me. I like to think of other white nationalists in other countries. I have connections with nationalists in France. I have connections with nationalists in Germany. I have connections with nationalists in Spain. And I know very fine nationalists in the United States of America. There are also fine nationalists in Canada and Australia, just to mention some countries. I don't know whether you think like this, but I like to think of other nationalists. I read their magazines and their periodicals, and I think of them having their difficulties and sometimes great successes. I'm not going to talk about the success on the continent, but there have been great successes over there. And if they can do it, we can do it. If we can do it, they can do it. I see this as the struggle of the white man to have a future. I'll tell you this. I'm very lucky here. I had a very happy childhood as a kid. My parents were very, very good. Good parents, good mother, good father. I had a happy childhood. And I do this, so that in 100 years from now, there'll be English, white, British kiddies having a happy childhood in a happy country, not this hellhole outside here,
yeah,
but in a happy country. And that is why I do it. They'll never know me. I've been well moved on by then. And I'll not know that. I won't know kids 100 years from now. But I know that if we keep our nerve and successful, there'll be English, white, British kiddies in 100 years from now, as there ought to be. So anyway, this is the leaflet that we dreamed up, which we put out thousands, and we intend putting a load more out. And the headline is, Voting for Mosques. Now, we put out quite a few of these, and you see someone, you know, doing their car or their garden, or a woman, you know, doing the windows, and you say, you know, we're just delivering our leaflet. This is in Walsall Park. We're against the mosque. And they all say, yes, we're against the mosque. We'll take your leaflet. And the headline is deliberately sort of provocative. Voting for mosques. Voting for mosques. And it goes on. A message to the residents of Walsall Park. Right, this is them. And it starts off. For decades, Labour, the Tories, the Liberal Democrats have actively promoted mass immigration into Britain. Since 1997, which is when New Labour came in, more than 3 million foreigners have come into our country, and immigration is running at more than 250,000 each year. Truly staggering figures. And the immigrants, of course, bring with them their cultures and beliefs. And the millions of Muslims want mosques and Islamic centres all over our towns. Goes on. Then you have two questions. Is this what you want? Is this what you voted for? We're trying to educate these people. Well, then the questions are answered. Well, if you voted Tory or Labour or Liberal Democrat, brackets, it makes no difference, because what these British people have got to understand is, vote Liberal or Con, it makes not the difference to anything. They're all the same, and that's something the British people have got to understand. They're all the same, because they're all anti-British, and they're all responsible for this immigration, they're all responsible for the crime in our cities, they're all responsible for ruining our economy by outsourcing all our jobs to the cheap labour comes to the Far East. They're also responsible for bankrupting the government. So, is this what you want? Is this what you voted for? Well, if you voted Tory, Labour or Liberal Democrat, it makes no difference. You are voting for immigration and you are voting for the steady erosion of our culture and way of life. And then it goes on to talk about our overcrowded country. And then it goes towards the end. We're now getting to Worcester Park. And it says, Worcester Park, do you really want a mosque in Worcester Park? Well, we know the answer to that question. They don't. Is this what you'll be voting for in the future? And then on the back, because we like to make use of every opportunity, there's some basic policies of ours. We've put out thousands of these, and we intend putting out even more thousands. And when we get 5 minutes, probably after these May elections, I think this leaflet could be turned into a national leaflet, not just Worcester Park, because these problems aren't just what we know. I think it might be revamped and put into a national leaflet, why ever not? Because our people are voting for immigration, voting for mosques. So that was that.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.